Okay, bonsoir, good evening. Welcome to the new year. As many of you know, I've been involved with Michael Mackey and Ingrid and Joanne to help co-organize this lecture series. And we have, of course, wonderful support. Always we've had regular support from the Dean of Science, Martin Grant, from the Dean of Medicine. And this year, remarkably, we've had support from the Faculty of Arts and also the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. And in the past, the Provost and the Principal have donated generously to provide these lectures, largely for the good quality wine that we serve after, so that you all enjoy with the speaker. As you know, Michael Mackey always would remind me, so now I have one of these things, cell phone, so please turn off your cell phone. Mine rang just before I got here, and by the time I got it out of my pocket, it had already finish the call, so they're not very useful anyway, but do turn them off, please. Well, today we're delighted to be able to host as our lecturer Dr. Alan Evans from the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery and also Biomedical Engineering. Alan is a physicist by training. He comes from England. His first degree is from Liverpool University. And then he went on to do a master's degree in medical physics and a PhD in biophysics, the latter at Leeds University. After a short postdoctoral period there, he came to Canada and he worked at the Atomic Energy on PET. I'll let him explain what that is. I had to look it up and I still can't remember. Something about positron emission tomography, that's right. And then after 5 years, he came to McGill in 1984. Shortly after receiving tenure, professorship coming in 1995, and today is a James McGill professor. I don't know where he gets the time or energy, but he's written a huge number of papers, about 2.5 times the number of papers I've written, and I'm much older than this guy, so how he does it, I don't know, but he's a very prolific author, very widely known, and seems to be a very popular lecturer in many parts of the world. He's won a number of awards, and he's currently the director of the Montreal Consortium on Brain Imaging. So it's a pleasure to welcome you here. As usual, we'll have a question period after the presentation, followed by a reception in the lobby, to which you're all welcome. So to hear now Dr. Evans on non-invasive mapping of the human brain. Thank you.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Lawrence. If I look a little bit stiff today, it's because I played squash yesterday with my students, and this was a bad idea. So standing for 50 minutes is going to be a trial, and one of the perpetrators actually walked into the room. Where are you? He's over there. You'll pay for that. So I'm going to talk to you tonight about non-invasive mapping of the human brain. Brain imaging research, it's what you do if you don't know what you want to do when you grow up, because it involves everything, mathematics, physics, chemistry, computer science on the one hand, and on the other hand, neurology, psychiatry, neurosurgery, cognitive neuroscience, and over the years, I've had the enviable task of trying to knit students from all of these different backgrounds together under one roof, and I have to say it's been a joy. It is just constantly stimulating to work with people from such diverse backgrounds, and you learn every day in this field. Let's see if I can work this thing. So that's the first question that people are going to ask. You know. Why do you need all of these toys? The Brain Imaging Center at the Montreal Neurological Institute is a wonderful environment where we have all kinds of brain scanners. I'll talk about some of these in this talk to look at the structure and function of the brain. Massive amounts of computation to analyze the data. We'll get into that as we go. The point being that this is not pretty pictures. It's not glorified. Doing quantitative analysis in multi-dimensions of the human structure and function. A lot of it is brain research trying to understand in groups some aspect of brain physiology or brain anatomy. This doesn't mean that it has no role in clinical management. An example might be this, where you see, in this case, a large brain tumor, a glioblastoma. It's pretty obvious in the second image. You can see the margins of that tumor. And what we're looking at there, across the top, are four different MRI scans, magnetic resonance imaging scans, through a slice through the brain. So you can see that. But it's only a picture. We want to turn that into quantitative information that we can measure and do, in this case, anatomical evaluation of the size and extent of that tumor. So all of those can be combined computationally and give us the map at the bottom, which shows you in various colors. We've identified computational means. Where's the border of the tumor? What's the edema, the fluid inside the tumor? The purple water around the outside of the tumor, different types of tissue, gray matter, white matter. Gray matter is what does the thinking. White matter is the cabling between the parts that do the thinking. So we can measure the size and extent in three dimensions of all of those structures. And this is useful for surgeons. They can take that information and turn it into three-dimensional visualization for the purposes of pre-surgical evaluation. And they can take that information into the operating theater and use that to guide the surgeon during the surgical process. And just to make the point that this has clinical relevance. Having said that, I'm not going to be talking much in this talk about individual clinical patient management. That's a whole different talk on neurosurgical imaging. So why do we use imaging in brain research? Well, first of all, most importantly, it's non-invasive. We're not cutting open the brain. It's a whole brain survey. We can measure various parameters in the brain at every 3D location in the brain at once. So you're not sticking a needle in one part of the brain to make some measurement. You don't know what is going on in the other parts of the brain while you do that. So we have a whole brain survey. We can look at how different parts of the brain talk to each other. So we can look at the connectivity. That has profound implications for understanding of how the brain works, because there's no such thing as the center for this and the center for that. It's all diffuse. Interaction amongst a set of regions and connectivity and how those regions talk to each other is the essence of how our brain works. It's multidimensional, as I said, three time space dimensions, and we also look across time to see how these physiology changes with time. It allows us to look at very large populations so that we're not making anecdotal measurements and characterizations in a single subject. We see what it's like across the population. And of course it allows us to put all this information out there in a quantitative form that other people and other researchers can access long after we might have finished our questioning of that data, so it's very efficient. Just to give you an idea of the space-time continuum, if you will, of the kinds of techniques one can use to study the brain. What you'll see here is that at the top end, various kinds of non-invasive imaging. That's PET, PET, functional MRI. I'll explain these in detail as we go. MEG looks at electrophysiology, and you can see that they have spatial resolutions on the order of a millimeter to a centimeter. It's up at the top. You can go with much finer detail with much more invasive techniques like patch clamp and light microscopy and single unit recording and multi-unit recording. So those go down to much finer detail, but they don't give you the whole brain survey. So this is, if you like, at the range of imaging devices that one can use to look at the brain. And as I say, I'll explain some of them. A little bit of background on the Montreal Neurological Institute, which is my home institution up at the top corner of the university. While the Penfield established the MNI in 1934, it was the first combined brain research institute and hospital. And we all still very much follow this ethos of maintaining a tight coupling between brain research and clinical management. Penfield conducted seminal work in mapping the brain by direct cortical stimulation to evoke some ancient memory or what part of the brain might be involved in smell or motor movements. But he did that by direct stimulation of the cortical surface, and they won't let us do that to students. Herbert Jasper developed EEG at the MNI in the 1940s. EEG maps the electrical activity in the brain. Brenda Milner, she established the field of psychology, neuropsychology, brain-based psychology, otherwise known as neuropsychology, through the starting in the 40s, and Brenda's still there. She's 94, and she shows up every day. And you better be on your toes because she's as sharp as a whip. Bill Findell is her competitor in the chronology stakes. Bill is also 94, and he also comes in every day. He identified what we call red veins. If you stimulate a part of the cortex, what normally are blue veins become red as oxygenated blood flows in. And he identified that back in the 50s. I'll reprise that as I talk because it became quite significant to what we call functional MRI starting in the 90s. So Penfield, as I say, brought together world-class brain research and first-rate neurological care and conducted clinical research in the living human brain. And this is basically what he was doing, right? Stimulate the brain, see what part of the body reacted to it. So we are following that principle, but we're doing it non-invasively using imaging in either volunteer populations of students or clinical populations. And brain mapping is a subset of brain imaging, which is essentially what I do, which combines all of these things, the clinical expertise, basic neuroscience, and the physical sciences, with imaging technology and massive amounts of telecommunication and high-performance computing. You need all of that to process the amount of data that comes up pouring off these scanners. This may look a little bit nerdy, but it's absolutely crucial to a lot of what will follow, and that is that we take three-dimensional data or four-dimensional data from individuals, and we map it all into what you might think of as a common shoebox. Everybody's brain is mathematically squeezed into that shoebox so that you can now talk about some particular location in brain, the XYZ coordinates of that piece, and you can have 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 measurements across 10,000 individuals at that point. And that allows you to start doing statistical and mathematical analysis of the variability of that parameter across that population. So it introduces the statistical dimension, and that's really the heart of brain mapping. It's exactly analogous to mapping the planet or mapping the universe. We have developed a cartographic plan of the brain, and we can look at the structure and function of the human brain and quantify it in the same way that early explorers would map the anatomy of the planet, if you will, or the way climatologists will map out the physiology of the planet. So with that by way of a generic introduction, let's start out with some functional imaging. Now, functional imaging, functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, is basically you lie in a gigantic pizza oven, and we stimulate your eyes perhaps with a screen and transmits a visual image to your eyes, and then we see what happens in your brain, subtle changes in blood flow in your brain associated with that stimulus. This is a gigantic magnetic field, 1.5 Tesla, typically maybe 3 Tesla, which is many times larger than the Earth's field, and all of the protons in your head get aligned straight up, and then we give them a little kick, and we see what parts of the brain respond to that little kick at slightly different rates, and that gives us information about the magnetic environment of each part of the brain. That actually turns into a brain signal in a way that I'll explain as we go forward. Now, there's a lot of issues between saying that and getting there. Technology rarely works the first time, and we're always making mistakes, and you know, things like that happen. I've walked more times than I care to remember into the MRI room with my watch on. Bad idea. Watch no work any longer. So these sorts of things go on. And as I said, here's the point. When Bill Findell identified red veins, he wasn't thinking of imaging technology. He was just studying the physiology of the brain in the surgical field. What happens is that the hemoglobin has, when it's carrying oxygen, changes its magnetic status from when it is not carrying oxygen. So when a particular part of the brain is at rest, you'll see that red hemoglobin, oxyhemoglobin flows in, and deoxyhemoglobin flows out. That's blue veins. When you activate that region, it's like watering the entire garden for one plant. There's an overproduction of oxygenated blood, and it turns into red veins. And that changes the local magnetic properties of that region. Well, how do we make use of that? Essentially like this. We take a functional image of the brain. You can't make out much because it's just a quasi measure of blood flow in the brain. So it's a blob of blood flow throughout the brain. And we do that again with some particular condition. That might be rest. You might be just lying there. If we do that repeatedly, we get a number of measurements of the brain at rest. And then we move to some activation condition. That might be a visual stimulus to suddenly come on. And we'll get a very slight change in blood flow. You can't even see it in these images that I'm showing you, but there has been a change in blood flow. We place a region of interest on the brain at some location. We identify whether there's been a subtle change in blood flow there. And if we map the blood flow in that region as a function of time, you see that there's been a change from the red state to the green state. And if we average that, we get the average red signal and the average green signal. And the difference between the two is a t-statistic of the change at that location. Of course, we do that at every location in three dimensions throughout the brain. And then you can map those statistical changes onto a map of brain anatomy. And now we see where in the brain was there a change in blood flow of a few percent in response to the change in the stimulus condition. That's it. There are any number of ways you can analyze this in more sophisticated ways, but that's the essence of the study. It's a very small percentage change in the magnetization in that area, which corresponds to the local blood flow. So here are some examples of that. On the top left, you see an activation condition, a baseline condition, which was look at these nouns. Look at this. I'll show you a bunch of pictures. A bike, you say bike. A knife, you say knife. Then I'll change the condition. I'll show you those same pictures, and now you tell me what you do with this. You see the bike, you say ride. You see the knife, you say cut. Everything is the same between those two states, except that in one case you said what it is, and in the other case you said what it was for. You made a semantic association, you had a semantic interpretation of that information, and we want to know what parts of the brain showed a statistical change. And there you see on the top left that particular example. In the middle, it's the same sort of thing. The only thing which is changing here is the orientation of that stimulus. Now you're not looking at just on-off. You're looking at a continuous variable, which is the angulation of that stimulus. And I don't know why it periodically stops, but let's just come back in again. Yeah, you see that the brain responds in the same, what we call, retinotopic fashion. So we're mapping the brain. And on the right, you see a last example, which is if we take a student and we stick a thermistor on their forearm, and we change it from very hot to painful. That's the part, one of the parts of the brain responds to pain. No, we don't fry their arm. It just goes from 44.5 degrees to 45 degrees. So the subtle distinction of that's hot but not painful to, yeah, that's getting a little bit painful. And the different parts of the brain are engaged in processing of heat as opposed to processing of pain. So if you want to understand the pain process, you would use a technique like this. You would examine various types of analgesia to overcome the pain response. You try and understand the pain mechanism. On the bottom, you see there the sensory and motor homunculus made famous by Penfield, where he, as I said, he walked around the brain and mapped each part of the brain in response to a sensory stimulus. What was the representation of your body on your brain surface? And this is all of us. What parts of the brain are involved in, are represented at the sensory side or at the motor side, and of course they're different. You see this homunculus on the right is a 3D representation of that, and you see very large mouth region and very large hand region because we have such tremendous ability with our hands and our mouth, so that's over-represented in brain. The point of this is that it took Penfield many years of painstaking work in the exposed brain, and we do it in students, nominally normal students, not invasively. So a couple of examples of that in studying clinical populations. So here you see an example in autism, where we've asked autistic children and typically developing children to look at familiar faces and unfamiliar faces. And the point is that the typically developing children, they will recognize a family member. And the brain responds, as you can see on the bottom there, differently to the familiar face compared to the stranger's face. Whereas the autistic spectrum child will show some diminished response in recognition of a familiar face. Another aspect of autism is the involvement of what we call mirror neurons, which essentially activate when you imitate the behavior of somebody next to you. Part of the social engagement is mimicking the person you're looking at or next to, as you can see with that person standing behind Jimmy Carter. So we can look at how the mirror neurons respond during imitation. Imitation is also important for language development. And when we look at the brains of these two populations, you see that the normal healthy control population brain shows a dramatically different functional response to copying of finger movements, another form of imitation, compared to the autistic brain. A way to extend that idea a little bit further is to look at the relationship between some brain measure, the extent of that blood flow activation, against some behavioral metric. In this case, we're looking at a measure of social cueing. And you see that in both of those cases, there's a direct relationship between the response in the brain and the performance on that behavioral test, in that psychological test of social competence. And so that the brain is reflecting your ability to act in a social setting, which is obviously one of the characteristics of autism. So that's functional MRI. I could go for hours on that, but I'm going to now change gears completely into another form of imaging that's called positron emission tomography, and otherwise known as PET. And as Lauren said, this is what I worked on when I first came to Canada in the 79. And this is a totally different type of technology. It's based around the existence of the positron. My wife still insists there's no such thing as a positron. The positron is a positive electron. And if a positron and an electron meet, they annihilate each other immediately and give off two gamma rays in opposite directions. So there's a line of response from where those two meet. So we take advantage of that principle by attaching a positron-emitting isotope to any substrate of interest to us. For instance, we can make a radioactive glucose. These are very, very small amounts of radioactivity, I should say. It's like having a gamma scan or a thyroid scan. It's tiny amounts of radiation. You can attach a positron label to radioactive sugar. And you can see where the radioactive sugar goes because that positron label is decaying and it gives off two gamma rays in opposite directions. And as you can see, if we have a ring of scanners around the outside, two detectors go off together when those two gamma rays go off in opposite directions, and they tell you there was a positron annihilation, a positron decay somewhere along this line. And if you do that for many, many such label decays, you can reconstruct what is the distribution of the tracer. And what you see on the top right as an example is one cut through a map of the glucose distribution in the human brain. On the bottom there, you can see three different cuts through the 3D representation of glucose metabolism in the human brain. The point about PET is that although its spatial resolution is not as good as functional MRI, it has massive chemical range. That's just an example of the various kinds of physiology, neurochemistry that you can study with PET. You can look at receptor distributions, you can look at energy metabolism, you can look at anything in the human brain by choosing what type of tracer you use. So some examples of that technology. You see here on the top the results of a thrombolysis therapy to restore blood flow in an infarcted brain. And you see basically on the top left, you see a bluish color. That shows a reduced blood flow in an area that's had an infarction, a stroke. And on the top right, you see that is now yellow and red. That essentially means that the blood flow has been restored due to the thrombolytic therapy. On the bottom, you see another example in the surgical realm of speech activation. If you do some speech stimulus, different parts of the brain will light up. And you see the red area shows you where, in this case, the Broca's expressive language area is located. And it's sufficiently far away from the green tumor that you can resect that tumor without affecting any obvious language areas. So that is whole brain blood flow or metabolism, glucose metabolism. You can also use it in a neurochemistry context to look at enzymes and receptor distributions. Some of you will know that this is a picture of the point where two neurons touch each other and communicate chemically. And basically what we are looking at with PET is the extent to which the tracer binds to receptors on the edge of that receptor. If you have a transmission of the neurotransmitter from one side of the synapse to the other side of the synapse, essentially that the impinging neuron activates the secondary neuron across the synapse. That's a chemical linkage between the two neurons, and the second neuron fires. So we want to measure oftentimes the density of the neurotransmitters, the density of the receptors on the other side of that synapse, and we can use PET to do in vivo chemical quantification of the density and concentration of those receptors or neurotransmitters. So a practical example of that might be in this case, in Parkinson's disease, where you see on the left-hand side a Parkinson's patient who's had on the right, I should show you here, on here you see a reduced amount of dopamine synthesis. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It should look like on the bottom, where you see a bilateral distribution of the neurotransmitter concentration. In a Parkinson's patient, you have this reduced amount of dopamine synthesis in this brain area, deep in the brain. And on the left-hand side here, you can see that there's been a treatment with a xenograft, an animal component which can be put in there and restore the dopamine function of that brain region. So we can see externally that this has worked in that particular xenograft. Another example of neurochemistry with PET is shown here, where we can see what parts of the brain are involved in amphetamine administration. Amphetamine is a drug which is often used as a recreational drug by addicts, and they want to get a high, a dopamine high, a release of dopamine. And you see those areas which show the greatest amount of dopamine release in response to the amphetamine administration. On below, you see the same response from alcohol-induced dopamine release. So what this says is that whether it's alcohol or drugs, you get it's a final common pathway between two different ways of getting a high. And so we can examine that chemically. Now I'm going to change course to structural imaging. Up until now, I've looked at physiology, blood flow, chemistry, metabolism. There's a lot that you can learn about brain development by looking at just straight anatomy in the brain. We'll start by looking at neurodevelopment, child brain maturation. It turns out that this is an understudied, normal development has been understudied in the past. People might look at brain disorders, ADHD or child onset schizophrenia or autism, but they wouldn't have a full characterization of the normal brain. So 10 years ago, the NIH, National Institutes of Health in Washington, commissioned a study to study 500 normally developing children aged from birth to 18 years of age. And all of this structural MRI data was collected to show us on the top the anatomy of the brain. I will go into more discussion of DTI fiber orientation in a moment, but this gives you pathways of wiring through the brain. And this was studied in children from birth to aged 18. And all of these children were also studied longitudinally. So every child was scanned multiple times. It's a huge database that was collected across the United States at the sites that you see there in that map. And all that data came to Montreal, which by itself is worth noting that a multi-million dollar US study came to Montreal as the coordinating site for that big study. So what you're looking at here is one example of that data. This is the, just look at the left-hand side to begin with. You're seeing one cut through a brain as it evolves in months. The clock at the top is ticking in months. So you go from birth to 48 months. And you can watch that brain evolve over time. Now here's the trick, it's not one brain. It's a composite drawn from 60 different brains and mapped together using that stereotaxic common shoebox idea that I showed you. So it's not anecdotal. It's what the brain does in a population. And you see right now, at 6 months, you see that the fiber pathways here, these fiber pathways going from the middle of the brain down to the visual cortex at the back of the brain. I'm going to let this go around again because it's worth spending some time on. Now it looks like an adult brain. I'll let this go back to birth so you can see how the white matter pathways change. Right now, it looks pretty much gray all over. And as you watch the clock ticking, you see that you get to 6 months, these white matter pathways from the center of the brain down to the visual cortex appear. Between 6 months and 12 months, the front of the brain starts to fill in. And this is when your child goes from being a sensory processing engine into a little person that is looking at you and understanding the world around them. It's that integration of the different parts of the brain that takes place between 6 months and 12 months, and we're looking right at it in this population. The other two images in the middle on the right are just different kinds of structural MRI image. We can look at different aspects of the magnetization in the brain to tell us different things about the fiber pathways in the brain. Now, as nice as that is, it's only a video. It's a visual representation of brain growth. we can quantify that. I hesitate to get too much into this, but the idea here is that we can look at the distortion from time point one to time point two in any single brain, and that gives us a map of the three-dimensional growth of that brain between those two time points. We can do it again from time point two to time point three, three to four, and so on. So we can build a map for that single brain of the growth tensor. I'm sorry, Lawrence. We can do that across subjects, multiple subjects. So we can now build an average across subjects, and we can build a map over the population. So we can build up a characterization of brain growth in the child brain, not a single child brain. And we can turn that into quantitative maps. Now, this is a busy slide, but bear with me a second. What you're looking at here are different cuts through a three-dimensional map of the brain growth at 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, and 48 months. So let me give you an idea. At 48 months, you see this piece of the brain here at the back. It's got a bright color. That means that area expanded dramatically between birth and 48 months. And if you look at the color bar here, it tells us that grew by a factor of about four from birth to 48 months. So the color coding is telling us how different parts of the brain grow. And we can turn that into either growth or growth rate. These are various metrics of the velocity of brain growth at each part of the brain. Now, what I'm going to show you now is a video which helps us capture all that information in a perhaps more digestible manner. But first of all, I have to explain something. Basically, the growth rate, the brain grows rapidly and then slows down. So the growth rate is dropping dramatically with time. So you might see that the whole brain is dropping down, the whole brain growth is dropping. But different parts of the brain, the front of the brain and the back of the brain, might have slightly different rates. And that's interesting in itself. So we can look at the absolute change in brain growth, or we can take out the average across the whole brain and just show that the red stuff and the green stuff shows different parts of the brain having differential growth rates. Why does that help us to understand? It's like this now. This is a three-dimensional, different cut through a three-dimensional map of brain growth, child brain growth. And you see that the top row goes quickly from colored down to black as the overall growth rate drops. The bottom shows us the differential growth rate. Some parts haven't slowed down as much as other parts, and that tells us how the brain is still evolving in more subtle ways as time goes on. And we can see that in the bottom row. The top row has gone to dark by about 12 months or so. And what you see on the bottom is that the anterior and the posterior parts of the brain start to separate, and the neocortex, the frontal lobes, are continuing to evolve long after the back of the brain has stopped and essentially stabilized. Another thing we can do with structural imaging is extract the cortex of the brain. What I mean by extract the cortex is we take the outside of the brain is made up of gray matter. It's a sheet of gray matter that's wrinkled and folded, but that's what does the thinking. It is connected by white matter fibers, which are the wires and the cables that run from one side of the brain to the other. We want to measure the thickness of that cortex everywhere, because this is an important biological parameter that changes with maturation and with disease. So we use these computational tools, as you can see, to extract the three-dimensional folding pattern of the cortex. This is not a picture as such, it's a map. It's a quantitative map, and we can take numbers at every part of the brain to understand that as it changes with disease or some other stimulus. So we extract surfaces like this, the gray matter surface, the outer surface of the brain, and the white matter surface on the bottom, which is the inner surface of the cortex. So you've got two, if you like, folded sheets, one inside the other, And the distance between the two is the thickness of the gray matter mantle. And that's important to us. So we can extract that information and we can start to visualize that. So I'm going to show you a map in a moment of the surface position of the brain cortex. The colors that you see there show you the difference between the left-hand side of your brain and the right-hand side of your brain in the developing child brain. And you'll see that that shows you a significant left-right asymmetry between the hemispheres of the brain. And we can map that as a function of time. So here you go again with a clock ticking in months up to, in this case, 54 months. It's an average result across 90 children. And you see that that bulge, that colored bulge, is maximal at about 30 to 36 months in the child brain. We can then say, well, that's fine if that's the exterior surface, but what about the thickness? What is the thickness of that cortical mantle everywhere? And if we do that, this is the same sort of thing, but it's a map of cortical thickness. You see there, on the left-hand side, you see the left and right gray matter hemispheres, and on the bottom you see the view from the inside of the brain. And what you see is that it's bright red. That means the cortex is very thick there in the early years of life. In fact, you can take that information over 18 years and you see that these colors will slowly fade away. What that's telling us is that the brain in the red areas has an initial overgrowth. It's very thick, there's lots of neurons, and as the child develops, these areas get thinner, the cortical neurons are removed and they fade away, and this is a dynamic process of brain sculpting and maturation that is associated with their maturation in behavior. And you see, just as this comes to an end, you see the blue stuff now is showing you that there's a particular thinning in motor cortex, areas which are involved in the hand motions or the body motion, and in visual cortex at the back of the brain. This is a continuous dynamic evolution of brain anatomy throughout maturation. This is a video that I always like to show. It took some famous researchers a large portion of their careers in the 80s to characterize the left-right asymmetry between the two hemispheres of the brain by careful measurement by hand of slice by slice by slice pictures of the brain. We essentially have done the same thing using computational analysis in 152 subjects. And what you see is it's flipping between the average left hemisphere and the average right hemisphere. So you see right away the asymmetry between left and right hemispheres. Top left is showing you a lateral view, and the other views are lateral, medial, top, bottom, front, back. So six different views of that same asymmetry map. So you're looking at a statistical map of left-right brain asymmetry, in this case, in an adult population. Now you want to relate anatomy to function, right? You now want to see how different parts of the brain development are associated with behavioral changes. And of course, the first thing to say is that maturation is multidimensional, and any parent will know exactly what I'm talking about here. So there are many dimensions of maturation, and this is always a politically correct slide. This shows the changes in various types of brain maturation for boys and girls in that population in this big study. And what you see on the top left is, as a function of age, up to 18 years of age, the performance on a word retrieval task. And you see that about puberty, at about 12 years of age, the boys, surprisingly, start to outperform the girls in a word extraction task. That I should emphasize, that's not language. It's a lot more to language than word retrieval, but it's good for the guys. We actually win one on the top left. Over on the bottom right, you see the maturation of fine motor dexterity. And the where you see that the girls dramatically start to outperform the boys at about the same age. So this is an interesting experiment on different forms of brain maturation in large populations. We can go beyond that in many different ways. These children were subjected to something like 60 to 70 different kinds of behavioral psychological evaluation, as well as all of the imaging. So there's a vast amount of data that sits there that we put into the public domain that anybody, any researcher around the world, can download and do interesting research on. This is very much part of the mapping culture, brain mapping culture around the world. Lots of people put data out there to be played with by other researchers. It's quite a communal effort. So this is one more example where we're looking at the association between some particular behavioral characteristic, in this case, aggressive behavior. You can capture that in a child behavior checklist task. And we ask the question, what parts of the brain, where is the cortical thickness most closely associated with aggressive behavior? And you see that blue region. It shows us those parts of the what we call the limbic brain, deeper parts of the brain, which are more closely associated with aggressive behavior. What we did find, which we found kind of intriguing, is that the aggressive behavior in boys is more direct and more specific. In girls, aggressive behavior is more distributed, more indirect. Does that sound familiar? A couple more examples. Here is cortical thickness in autism. So we're seeing where are the cortical thickness differences between a population of autistic children and a population of typically developing children. And you see, I'm not going to go into depth here, but you see areas where there are clear differences in cortical thickness in each group, which are exactly where we would have expected to find them. Associated with what we know to be the functions of areas which are associated with the deficits that we see in autistic populations, social cognition, repetitive behaviors. These are exactly where we would have expected to see them functionally with fMRI, and we see them also in structural changes. So anatomy follows function. Another example of that is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. And you see here a study of 200 ADHD kids and 200 typically developing kids. And essentially, these maps show you the change in cortical thickness from age 7 to 12. And what you're supposed to take away from this is that the ADHD population, these children, their frontal cortex is delayed in maturation by about 2 to 2.5 years compared to the typically developing children. And this is what you expect. The behavioral deficits of ADHD kids are that they have a reduced ability to focus, lack of attention, impulsivity. All of these things are functions that are associated with the prefrontal areas. So it's no surprise, but it's gratifying to see that these are exactly the areas that we see that there's a delayed development. Turns out that there's one area in these children that we showed an enhanced growth, an accelerated growth, and there it is. Those areas showed an increased cortical thickness in the ADHD children, and this happens to be motor cortex. Bilateral motor cortex, so it's entirely consistent with the hyperactivity component of this disorder. So I've shown you relationships between behavior, various clinical indices, and brain physiology, brain anatomy. You can also start to explore the genetics of this. How much is genetics playing a role in these disorders? So we can look at, for instance, the conjunction, in this case, of a diagnosis for ADHD, a clinical diagnosis, and the presence or not of what's called the DRD4 receptor. DRD4 is the dopamine receptor D4 subtype. And this is a particular gene subtype which has been associated with, suspected to be associated with the presence of ADHD. So you can ask the question, how does that presence or not of that disease, of that gene, sorry, associate itself with the presence of cortical thickness phenotype, a difference in the observable brain? And what you see in the graphs on the right is that there's a continuum between ADHD with the gene at the bottom to normal volunteers without the gene. And what that means is it's a gene dosing effect. That means that the manifestation, the penetrance of that particular disorder is associated with a change in cortical thickness in that particular prefrontal area of brain. So we're now relating what is the influence of gene on brain anatomy. It's a similar story for a region at the back of the brain on the bottom there. Now hold on to your hats. This, doing a gene analysis where there's one variable, presence or absence of gene, that's complicated enough mathematically. But you typically, when one does that, if you don't know what gene you're looking at, you might, for instance, say, I want to look at which genes are associated with presence or absence of this particular disease, let's say multiple sclerosis for the sake of argument. And the only variable is yes, no. And you can look across 500,000 to a million genes to find which ones most associate with that particular disorder. What we're now starting to do is this. We're doing that genome-wide association study, the GWAS, but we're not looking at the presence or absence of disease. We're looking at the measurement of a particular brain parameter that might be the concentration of dopamine, it might be the cortical thickness at any location. And you're doing that in every 3D location in brain. So you are now perhaps looking at 256 cubed 3D locations throughout the brain. And you're doing a very massive computational GWAS, genome-wide association study, at each location. So you're combining two massive computational areas together. So the permutations of that, the combinatorics of that, become immense. So I'll come on to, that's why we need big computers a little bit later. I'll just show you a couple of slides which show that everything that I've talked about in extenso in the child brain, we can do the same sorts of things in any other clinical population. So here's some examples from neurodegeneration. This shows you the change in cortical thickness as a function of time in Alzheimer's disease. And the red stuff is the bad stuff. That's the cortical thinning in specific areas of brain. And this takes place over about 2.75 years in this particular population. You see the dynamic changes in neurodegeneration. My colleague, my squash avatar up there, Andrew Reed, has done this analysis in a very large population of Alzheimer's disease subjects, which our colleagues around the United States have put into the public domain for analysis. This is the so-called ADNI database. And if you look at the left-hand side, we're looking at the difference in cortical thickness between a normal control population and age matched to an Alzheimer's disease population. And we are looking to see what parts of the brain, of the Alzheimer's disease brain, show a characteristic thinning. And the red stuff shows you the significant loss in cortical thickness in that Alzheimer's population. You see up there at the top left, I've listed 200 normal controls, 400 MCI, that's mild cognitive impairment. That's halfway, if you will, between normal controls and the 200 ADs. These are people who may or may not go on to develop AD. We don't know yet if MCI is a necessary precursor of Alzheimer's disease. So we can start to look at these subtypes, the differences between normal controls and the halfway house, and see if there's something that it can tell us which subpopulations might or might not go on to develop the disease. This is an active aspect of research. Just the same way as I showed you a relationship between behavior and anatomy in the child, we can look at memory performance. MMSE is a measure of memory performance. So we want to know what parts of the brain in the typical Alzheimer's brain show a relationship between cortical thickness and performance on a memory task. And you see that the areas which show the greatest correlation are these red areas. Those are the areas which are earliest to be affected by incipient Alzheimer's disease. So we're starting to build up a picture of the natural history of the disease. Not just Alzheimer's disease, we can look at multiple sclerosis with these kinds of mapping techniques. Multiple sclerosis is essentially a disease where you have a few focal lesions in the brain which affect the white matter connectivity, the ability of different parts of the brain to talk to each other. And so you might see in one patient, you see a few little lucencies, a few little bright spots on these various MRI images in gray. And we can use our computational tools to mathematically extract the red stuff to tell us these are where the MS lesions are in this one patient. We can use this kind of approach to start to explore across the entire population. And so on the right-hand side, you see a map derived from 425 MS subjects. And we wanted to know, so what is the typical distribution of MS lesions in the brain? And the colors essentially show you where is it most dense? Where does one usually find MS lesion distribution? And if I take that information on the right, and it's a few slices through a three-dimensional object, so it may be not obvious exactly what those yellowy blobs represent, I can take that information and represent it as a 3D video, just to perhaps simplify the case. The red stuff here is the fluid spaces in the middle of the brain, and the Klingon starship, the green stuff, is the MS lesion distribution in the brain. So this was the first time that one could quantify and capture what is the natural history of MS in a large population. And parenthetically, the pharmaceutical companies might be wanting to know, did my drug interfere with the MS process? So they would be asking a mathematical question, in effect, which was, did I reduce the amount of the green stuff between drug and no drug states? You're no longer doing a chemical evaluation with some rather vague assessments of performance. You're doing a quantitative mapping of the distribution of the disease and the impact of the drug on that disease. So everything becomes a statistical map. Connectivity. We can talk about different parts of the brain talking to each other. Here you see the wiring. The colored pictures on the bottom show you different pathways from different sides of the brain. Connectivity. I'm sure you're familiar with metabolomics and proteomics and genomics, and so now we have connectomics. Home sweet home. So there are different ways to look at connectivity. You can look at connectivity of white matter, these pathways that I've shown you. You can look at functional connectivity, how different parts of the brain talk to each other functionally, whether the blood flow goes up and down in a similar way between different brain regions. You can look at structural, the extent to which the cortical thickness from different parts of the brain changes over time. So this is a whole different way of examining brain function and structure. Looking at the connectivity. And the way we do that is we look at the MRI data, and we can ask the question, does the water flow along? If the water diffusivity is along a neuron, that's good. It can't get out the sides of a neuron. It can only go along the neuron. That means the neuron is well structured. That may then allow us to, I wish I had a pointer here, that may allow us to characterize different parts of the brain water diffusivity. That shows you on the right, that's something that we call fractional anisotropy. Don't be frightened by the term. What it means is to the extent to which water can flow in one direction or the other. And we can turn that into maps of water flow, and we can track fibers along those pathways. And then you see on the bottom right, that allows us to extract the pathways, the white matter pathways in the brain. So this, for instance, will show you on the bottom here, the different colors represent the orientation of those fiber pathways. I always forget which one is which. Red is left, right, green is top, bottom, and blue is front, back. So we're now not just measuring the concentration of water flow, we're measuring the direction of water flow, and that allows us to quantify fiber pathways in the brain. And for instance, here you see where the arrows are pointing, we're watching the change in the superior longitudinal fasciculus, a major white matter pathway, from birth through 1 year, 2 years, three, six, up to adulthood. And we can see that that fasciculus becomes more and more well-structured over a period of 6 to 10 years. So there are still slow changes taking place in brain over a very long time. We can visualize those pathways, and we have great fun with our computational tools, and start to explore the visualization, those pathways, how they work in three dimensions, what parts are connected to what, and how they change as a function of time. So I'm going to finish now with just a couple of comments on the high-performance computing that we've had to put in place to allow us to analyze these data in these huge populations in a way which is allowing us to have a whole new perspective on brain structure and function with very large numbers of subjects. We've wired up the country. We've taken hold of 80,000 processors across the country. Brain images are essentially cuckoos. We've taken over the supercomputing grid of the country because our data and our problems are so complex. Large communities are using this data that we've never got enough computers to allow us to answer our questions. And the supercomputing guys love this because they always have these huge monster machines and nobody's using them. So that's a happy marriage. Now, some of you may know that there can be problems with very powerful grid computing systems that become out of control. The biggest problem that one has had in the past is that it takes a week to get the data in, a second to analyze it, and a week to get the data out, which means it was worthless. You could have done it in your own house in 2 days. So what we've done with this thing called C-Brain is to wire up the entire Canadian supercomputing grid in service of brain mapping applications. And one example of a user community that is using this is the NeuroDevNet network of centers of excellence across the country, which are looking at various child brain disorders like autism and fetal alcohol syndrome. But this is all making use of the C-Brain grid and the computational tools you've heard me describe today. And the megalomania continues. We're taking over Europe and North America next. We are developing linkages with our colleagues across the planet in different bilateral projects. This is the supercomputer grid in Germany, Jülich, and they are doing the same thing as us. And so we've wired up their computing grids in Europe to ours in Canada. We're also doing this with our colleagues in Korea. This is the Korean Institute for Science and Technology. Same deal. They're doing brain mapping experiments, and we're hooking up our grids to theirs. The obvious goal is, in the long run, to have everybody essentially using common tools and assembling large databases from different countries. India's joining us. My colleagues in India actually have a postdoc in my lab from this group in Delhi. They're establishing the Indian Dementia Imaging Project using the imaging analysis pipelines from the MNI. And essentially, this is the map so far of what we call the C-Brain global grid. We even have a blob in Ethiopia. A former graduate student in our lab has gone back to Ethiopia and essentially is establishing an outstation there. And as you can see, this is in the last year, the rise of the user community, both locally and internationally, using the C-Brain grid. So watch this space. That's happened in the space of the last year. What's the goal? Obviously, it's to establish Montreal as a global hub for brain mapping. This is a psychological experiment. How many of you are looking at the world? And how many of you are looking at the brain? Who sees it as the world? Raise your hands if you see it as the world. And who sees it as the brain? Yeah, so most people see it as the brain. Yeah, it's unfortunate that New York disappeared down the central sulcus. So I've thrown a lot of things at you, and of course there'll be ample time for questions, but the one important thing that you must do is remember this quote from St. Augustine in the 4th century. The good Christian should be aware of mathematicians and all those who make empty prophecies. The danger already exists that mathematicians have made covenant with the devil to darken the spirit and confine man in the bonds of hell. It works for me. And of course, everything that I've described to do, you can do anything you set your mind to when you have vision, determination, and an endless supply of expendable labor. That would be him and Natalia. And there's another one there, the students from my lab. So obviously, they're the ones that do all the work, and it's a pleasure to work with this spectacularly stimulating group of students, fellows, and staff. And only some of them are shown there. As I said at the outset, this is a rodeo. It's a massive three-ring circus pulling together people from all kinds of disciplines, and it is a hell of a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Very nice. Okay, we have time for some questions. Of course. Okay, one question, not two.
You discussed the linkage between the imaging of the brain and behavior, and I'm just wondering several related parts. One, ever since time immemorial, people have talked about soul and mind. The modern view is that this is all brain functioning. The first part of the question is, do we see any difference when people are dealing with these matters as opposed to sort of everyday ones? The second part of the question is, what about predisposition? Do we get pictures? Can we predict that based on brain imaging, certain people have certain tendencies which will likely happen? And third and lastly, you talk about genetics, which has a tendency to promote determinism, and yet today in epigenetics, the suggestion is the environment can counter-affect the effects of genetics. And so my question here is, having done comparisons of where you, in terms of environmental changes and genetic modifications in terms of imaging.
Okay. First one. Soul.
Or mind.
This is obviously a very, very complex question. What has been happening in the last few years, which I find fascinating, is that we can study what happens in the resting state. When there's no particular stimulus, what is the brain doing? And we find that there are a set of regions in the brain which activate when the brain does nothing. And they deactivate when the brain does something, and other regions come on to handle what's being done. And these resting state networks have a few subcomponents, and one of them is called the default mode network. And we find that these regions are associated with consciousness. In experiments that we actually did in 95, not really fully understanding the implications of the experiments, you can associate blood flow in the brain with the level of anesthesia. And you go from fully awake to fully under. And three, fortunately, we have card-carrying anesthesiologists who are involved in this for purposes of studying anesthesia. But what they were looking at was what areas are involved in consciousness. And we see these regions now being called the default mode network, what the brain get activated when you're doing nothing. It's self-reference, the internalization. So this is the closest we've come to trying to identify regions which are not for anything in particular. So does that help you with question? Yeah. I of course, this is, I said, a complex question. There, you would then want to try and manipulate that particular set of regions against various external stimuli and see how it responds to them. You'd like to see how it changes across age. You'd like to see how it changes with drug influence. Or there's an infinite number of ways we can take this. But we're very much at the early days of connectivity analysis. Second question?
Predisposition.
It's a shame that my partner in crime, Michael Meany, has just taken off to Singapore to get involved in one of these kinds of studies I briefly described. He's one of the world's authorities on epigenetics, and he and I, together with colleagues in this room, are building a center for neuroinformatics and genomics to examine exactly that, the relative influence of nature and nurture on some particular disease or some particular trait. It's not going to be a simple story of it's all genes or it's all behavior.
Okay.
You did also mention predisposition. We know that if you have a dopamine DR4-7 repeat allele, you'll have what we call novelty-seeking tendencies. Certain personality traits are associated with particular gene subtypes. And so that is known independent of imaging. This particular gene is associated with that particular behavior. What we're doing with imaging is filling in between the two. So what does that particular gene mean in terms of brain structure and brain function, which underpins that behavior? So this is a general strategy of linking genes, behavior, and imaging, imaging as the, quote, phenotyping, endophenotyping, to associate with the gene and the behavior.
Okay, next question. Right to
that. Talk about children and different disease processes. Is there someone studying people in their 90s going into their 100s and saying why?
It's funny. I just came back from a meeting in Miami. It's amazing how often I have to go to Miami in January. And there is a study called the 90-plus study, which says exactly that. And the principal investigator of the study, she said, so many existing studies of aging stop at 90. They exclude people beyond that. And she said, because it's a very difficult thing to do to get people in their 90s to be able to get through what can be an arduous imaging behavioral study. And their whole project is that's exactly what we want to do. It's called the 90-plus study. I'm sure you can Google it.
Okay, one question. Look at the back, and we'll come down. Okay, please.
I was just wondering, I keep on hearing in interviews with big stars, you know, from music, that they have this proficiency, this what I find incredible ability to hear the music in their brains and then coming onto the instrument and composing it or playing it. It's more than the, you know, top of the population perhaps who plays a musical instrument or, you know, lead music or what have you. It's people who actually hear the music in their brains and can just translate it into, you know, into reality. My question is, has science explained where does that come from, that sort of wherever that music comes from? And also, is it just a gift actually, or is it something one can develop just like any other strength?
Well, you've come to the right place in terms of McGill, because some of the best people in the world are, I'm thinking particularly of Robert Satori, Z-A-T-O-R-R-E. That's his research, is to use various forms of research, imaging being one of them, to study music, auditory processing, and he's published a number of papers on issues such as perfect pitch. Some people have perfect pitch, some people don't. their brains are wired differently. He studied what that actually means in terms of brain structure and brain anatomy. So you can go and look up those papers to examine that work. He's also published work on how the brain's response to musical chills. Certain music that you listen to will absolutely give you that hairs on the back of your neck rise when you hear a certain note in a particular song. That's not just a physiological response, it's a brain response. And they've published on how the brain does that. So the short answer to your question is that there are numerous studies going on right now which are examining brain wiring and brain physiology in subpopulations of with auditory and musical expertise. And it's going on here between the Schulich Center for Music and Zatori at the MNI. So.
Well, thank you for a superb presentation. My question is about, I have a pair of questions about computing. There's a story, perhaps you could tell me whether it's apocryphal, about the late great Gregory Hansfield, but when he first started out in his work that would eventually lead to the CAT scan, he was told that the computations that he wanted to do were impossible. So my question is, how do your need for computing power, how does it compare to, say, with meteorology or weather prediction? And two, what computations would you like to do, or are you dreaming about?
The best way to summarize that is, I made some allusions to it during the talk, that when we look at the structure and function in the brain, it's the same as looking at the earth sciences or climate sciences in the planet, right? It's quite allegorical. You're looking at spatial maps of some parameter and how it changes with time. However, we don't have one planet. We have 1,000 brains. Or 10,000 brains. So you have to do that in each one of them, and then you have the whole statistical dimension to look across the 1,000 examples where you do that same thing. So the computations that you get into become immense. I made just brief references to the fact that you were interested increasingly in connectivity. If you think about it, what that means is that if you have n three-dimensional locations, and you can do some complex mathematics at that, then say, no, I'm not interested in just what's going on at this location. I want the joint combination at both at two different locations. It then becomes an n squared problem. If n is already a million, it's now a billion. Oh, I'm in North America, a trillion. That's the British North American thing on billions. So once you start to get into connectivity, you've changed the game completely, and now it's a whole different game to look at n squared problems. If you then try and do some complex mathematics at each location, like genome-wide association study, the connectivity of genome-wide association studies, then it becomes science fiction. So what we do is never going to suddenly say it's done. What we've experienced in the last 15 years has been quite palpable. We've gone from not asking so many questions because the answer would take 6 months to generate into, well, we can do that overnight now, and we can change a whole bunch of parameters to explore that parameter dimension, which was just inconceivable just 10, 15 years ago.
Okay, question on the left here, then.
Yeah, my question was just about imaging, because when you showed us some pictures from the fMRI, they were pretty vague, and you said that you mapped these onto a much sharper, detailed brain.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, given the neural connections you're trying to study, how do you make sure that you're mapping it onto an accurate part of the brain if the blood flow changes are sort of so vague in the fMRI?
That's what I didn't make clear. You do the fMRI, and in the same session, you do a structural MRI. So you have the two that are already spatially coincident.
It's not a generic brain, it's that person's brain.
what we do, we have this person's structure, this person's function, and they're 3D co-registered. Quite separately from that, we take this information and we want to map it into some coordinate space which allows us to look across subjects. I didn't get into what I meant by mapping, I just said a shoebox. How you get from this individual subject into that shoebox is the topic of huge amounts of research in our field, whether it's a nonlinear warping or a linear warping, and you didn't want me to go into that level of methodology.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Sounds as if you have almost an unlimited ability to look at the brain. How do you decide what research you're going to do, what the priorities are for this kind of research?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think the first answer to that is that much of what I've described are basic methodologies illustrated by different applications and different ideas. Each of those application domains has its own community of researchers. That's all they do. They only look at autism. They only look at Alzheimer's disease and so on and so forth. But they all collapse down onto the same platform of methodologies. So first of all, it's not my priority. It's each of those communities set their own priorities, and they take advantage of these techniques. However, it's not just a service function. There's a tremendous amount of interaction between the neuroimaging methodology communities and the neuroscience domain-specific questions. So we don't have to set priorities. They can set their own priorities. And then it becomes a national debate whether we should put money into child development, whether we should put money into aging, and so on and so forth.
Okay, question? I got a very simple question. I'm left-handed. Surprisingly, since the ballpoint pen was invented, left-handers in the world went from 8% to 12%. So obviously, people were held back because...
Is that right? I didn't know that.
So we became right-handed, so I did in school. Anyways, what happens now, I've got grandchildren, and they're half left-handed, half of them, I mean, 50%. But they know that if you're a baseball player, mm-hmm. and if you're a left-handed pitcher, you get $1 million more a year on average than a right-handed pitcher. So I want my grandchildren to be left-handed. Right?
Yeah, I know. No, that doesn't work that way because they get the extra money.
Do I do any harm by, like when they're 3 years old, I get anywhere from 3 to 20 sort of thing.
Well, first of all,
I'm telling my 3-year-old granddaughter to be left-handed. I don't know if you know that.
Speaking as a lefty, I know this pain. But the left-handed advantage in sports is only an advantage because the left-handed is unique, is rare. So we're used to operating in a right-handed world. They're not used to operating in a left-handed world. So if everybody is 50-50 split, there's no advantage. The advantage is only if you're in a minority. Nobody really knows. And there might be people in the audience who know more than I do, but to my understanding, we still do not understand why some people are left-handed, why it isn't just completely random, and if it was random, then it should be just 50-50, right? It's not 50-50, so what is the preponderance of rightness? We don't know why.
Okay, I think we'll call it. There are no other questions. I think this is a fascinating presentation and a really nice round of questions. So thank you again very much.